You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 140. And with me tonight is my good friend Robert Margolis. And Robert's been on the show before, but you know, it's August, and I tried to get a group together, and Robert was the guy who said, "Yeah, I'll be there." And how you doing, Robert?
Doing all right, Rod. How you doing?
I can't complain. If I did, nobody would listen.
Yeah.
So we're getting real close to an important event for a competitive industry to the nuclear industry.
Yeah, I was actually thought about it. Was reminded of it on the way home flying from Maine. There was an ad from the state of Pennsylvania for the 150th anniversary for the discovery of oil in Pennsylvania.
Yep. Actually, I think the to be more technically correct, they knew oil was there. It's just the anniversary of Edwin Drake's first actual drilling for oil. The first oil well was drilled on August 27th, 1859.
And, yeah, that's right.
And it was a successful drilling, by the way.
Yes. And they have a website, I assume, to promote tourism to that area of Pennsylvania. And I noticed that they had a lot of interesting facts, but the thing that really came across me was that they celebrated it as a big anniversary, whereas of course in our industry we seem to I shouldn't say celebrate, but people seem to only want to commemorate
our failures, you mean?
Well, just like recently, I know we'd been submitting a few emails on the sodium reactor experiment, which actually in many ways was a success, but of course in 1959 they had melted some fuel, and that's what the newspapers like to talk about.
What happened when it melted fuel? This was an experimental reactor in California, right?
Yes, it went online in November of 1957, and I guess depending on which way you read your history, because I know that we generated electricity the first time in 51 in Idaho, and then powered a town using nuclear power. And then November of 1957, the sodium reactor experiment was the first time a commercial grid, as I recall, connected up a reactor.
Yep. And so in 1959, this sodium reactor had, what, a loss of coolant flow, and that caused the fuel to overheat.
That's what I read. I've read different things on the subject, but certainly they had melted they'd melted some fuel, and there was some kind of release. Although depending on which reports you read, and I'm not as up on liquid metal. The fuel that is used in that liquid metal reactor, as I recall, was not ceramic. So some of the reports I even read said that, for example, you couldn't really get much iodine coming out of it, some of the things that we typically worry about with a light water reactor, because with metallic fuel, the iodine is typically kept inside the fuel, so it would release other isotopes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that most liquid metal cooled reactors used metallic fuel because it had better heat transfer characteristics. Generally speaking, those reactors were very small and fed fairly high power densities, so they were concerned about the heat transfer from the fuel into the coolant.
That's my recollection also. In fact, a lot of the original research reactors were like metallic plate fuel.
Yep.
And then they went to ceramics, I think, in the later core. In fact, I'm trying to even remember on Shippingport. I think Shippingport originally started with plate fuel and moved to the rod, to the ceramic rods.
I think they started, when they started developing the Shippingport, they were looking at the plate fuel. But I'm pretty certain that by the time they built Shippingport, they had figured out that the uranium oxide was a very stable fuel material, could withstand very high temperatures in the center of the rod. And I'm pretty sure they started with rods, but they may have, you may be right. They may have gone plate first.
So it's been a while since I looked up about the first core of Shippingport. So
I mean, I know a lot more about the last core of the Shippingport than I do about the first core of the Shippingport.
Oh well, of course that was of course the most fascinating core, with the thorium using it for thorium breeding in a light water environment.
Yep. That's designed by Alvin Radkowski, who later on, several years later, I think 1990 or so, founded a company based on thorium reactor fuels. And the company Thorium Power has been working ever since to try to market the Radkowski designs. I don't think they've done anything actual commercial yet.
The only thing I've heard is they've done some work with the Russians, and of course they have some contracts, consulting contracts with the United Arab Emirates, and my memory escapes me if they have anything with India, because I know India is really they have a lot of thorium in India, and the Indians are very interested in the thorium design reactors.
Yeah, it looks like Thorium Power is actually found themselves a way to keep their operations going with this consulting contract in the United Arab Emirates, because that's a pretty lucrative opportunity there. They're helping the UAE set up a regulatory environment so that the UAE can move forward with its plan to build a pretty significant number of reactors. I think their initial plan is to have 3 large reactors operating before 2020.
That's what I'm hearing also. I hear the first reactor, they want to get it operating by 2017. In fact, there was an interview with Dale Klein just after he left being the NRC chairman. He's still in the NRC, but as a regular commissioner, and he was talking about how many of the senior NRC staff have been hired away by the Arab Emirates to help set up their regulatory program.
Yeah, I think the Arab Emirates have actually done some employee scavenging in the UK as well. I came across an article that indicated that some of the leaders in the UK's nuclear industry are very concerned about the brain drain that's moving to the high-paying Middle East. UAE has indicated they plan to hire something on the neighborhood of 2,300 Western technical specialists to help them build their reactors. And I think there's about 3 or 4 consortiums that are really interested in bidding for the reactors.
Yeah, they're certainly moving ahead fairly quickly. I know they're part of I think it's the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, that has been actively pursuing nuclear development in the Middle East.
Yeah, of course, a lot of folks would look at the Middle East and say, why would they want to develop nuclear? They've got all that oil there. So what's your take on that?
Well, of course, it does remind me a little of Mexico. Mexico built the Laguna Verde plant during a time of high oil prices because they found they would make more money selling the oil than the expense of building the nuclear plant.
Yeah, one of the things that kind of gripes me is every time I talk about nuclear as a way to reduce the world's consumption of oil, they say, well, we don't burn oil in electrical power plants. And I say, don't forget, the U.S. is not representative of the world's market. in the Gulf, I think that nearly 100% of the electricity is produced by either burning natural gas or burning oil. There's almost no coal at all.
Yes, they certainly burn a lot of oil over there, and versus the United States, which of course we're very heavily we went heavily natural gas, especially during the late 80s and into the 90s.
Yeah, of course, lots of folks disagree with me, but I also will point to the statistics, which say that as late as 1976. Fully 17% of the electricity in the U.S. was being produced by burning oil, and now it's about 2%. The big change since 1976 is that nuclear's market share in 76 was about 3%, and it's now 20%. Suspiciously, those two numbers kind of match up.
Well, of course... And I should have saved a copy of this, but long ago, the predecessor of the NEI, which now the Nuclear Energy Institute, it was the U.S. Council for Energy Awareness. They quoted a report from OPEC talking about the permanent loss of oil demand to the United States due to the use of nuclear energy.
That's interesting. I would love
that. Was
that.
Back in the early 1980s. It was when I was in college, so I saw that in the early 1980s, and... I've not been able to locate that since, but I do remember I even spoke to someone at Council for Energy Awareness to make sure what they were saying was true, and I would not think it false. Certainly, once you put a nuclear plant online, they run 40 to 60 years, and so you're not going to be that's oil you're not going to be burning.
Yeah, well, here's another. Country, actually two more countries that were significantly dependent on oil for electricity production and shifted away, and that's France and Japan. If you look at their electricity market, France was almost 100% oil in 1973, mostly coming from Algeria, which was a colony of France back in that time, and Japan also burned an awful lot of oil in their power plants. Interestingly enough, in the last 2 years, Japan's consumption of oil and liquefied natural gas in their electrical power plants has gone up significantly. And you know why that is?
Well, I know, of course, they've had several reactors down because of the earthquake a couple of years back, and that they're trying to get those reactors back online.
Yeah, I can't pronounce the KK reactor's name, Kawishiwa Kawari or something like that. There's seven reactors there, and they have all been shut down up until about 2 months ago. All seven were shut down, and that's the largest single nuclear power station in the world, which caused, I think, TEPCO, which is Tokyo Electric Company, had to import an extra $200 to $300 million per month worth of fossil fuels.
Yes, yes. And, of course, it was the concerns over fossil imports that drove also South Korea to go heavily into nuclear also in the late 70s and all the way through the present day.
And did you work in South Korea?
Yes, I was a startup engineer on the first two of the combustion engineering units, the Yongwang 3 and Yongwang 4 units. And it was very interesting going over there and not just working on the power plants, but also, of course, experiencing the Korean culture, and also got to talk to them a little about why they went for nuclear, and they talked about how they were hit pretty hard by the steep oil prices in the 1970s, and their various ministers and folks who are in their energy business, they thought that wasn't a very good idea. And even though there's lots of natural gas nearby in Siberia, there's a little country called North Korea that kind of gets in the way of putting a pipeline. And so when you compare liquefied natural gas to nuclear, nuclear is very competitive. It was even competitive back in the 80s when everyone thought natural gas was so cheap. Mm-hmm. But that's, of course, pipeline natural gas.
Right. Now, Now, in the 80s, didn't the price of oil drop dramatically? And why wouldn't a country like Korea have forgotten all about the high prices?
Well, the folks that had experienced it, they became senior ministers, and they had long memories, we'll just say.
That's one of the things that just, you know, big difference between the United States and people in the Far East or in even in European countries. The memory stays with people when they lose control over something like oil prices or even oil supply, the quantity of oil. They don't forget that lesson.
Well, also, of course, South Korea is still in a technical state of war with the North. And so if there were to be some kind of emergency where they were blockaded, you run out of oil pretty quick. But, of course, with if you've imported uranium, that can last you for a long time because, of course, the higher energy density of the uranium.
You know, one of the things that's interesting looking at American foreign policy, how many times that we put economic embargoes on people, and, of course, economic embargoes are used as tools of policy frequently. It's hard to embargo a country that has its own nuclear reactors operating.
Yes, the South Korean, in the case of South Korea, they're very much national security and energy security are very hot topics for them. So they made different energy choices than even a nation like the United States, where we had abundant natural gas and folks were looking for the cheapest fuel source.
Yeah, that's what we say.
Well, it was certainly at $2 per million BTU in the 80s. I remember I used to joke with my colleagues in Sweden. I went to Sweden back in the 90s, and they talked to me about their young generation program, how they always pair up some older person with someone fresh out of school, and they asked if we had something like that in the United States, and I said, oh, yes, we do. Every time someone comes in who's under 35, some old guy will come running right up to him and say, get out of the business while you still can. Natural gas is going to take over everything, and we're all going to be out of a job. And as I was, I'm still waiting for my unemployment check, but so far it hasn't arrived, and I keep going to work.
I used to tell people I've never met an unemployed ex-nuke.
Well, or even an unemployed nuke.
Yeah. I want to go back to this experience you had of being a startup engineer. I'm going to emphasize that, Robert, just in case somebody's looking for a startup engineer in the next few years. They're going to come looking for people like you who can train startup engineers.
Well, it's funny you mention that. I have to tell one quick story. I was at a dinner a little while back with some of my former colleagues who worked in Korea, some of the old CE guys who are now with Westinghouse. And one of the gentlemen that was with him was kind of looking at me funny, and he actually said, I heard that you exist, but I couldn't believe it until I saw you, because I was the youngest person that CE had sent multiple times to the Korean location. So I was 28 at the time, so I'm one of the few guys under 50, so he was like looking at me like it was from outer space or something.
You are a unique man. There's not too many Westerners with the experience of starting up for the first time a new reactor. That's going to be one of the challenges we have. There's a few. Mostly, though, their experience is starting up smaller reactors.
And, of course, there are probably those, some in my generation, who were at Watts Bar or even the recent, the TVA, when they brought Browns Ferry 1 back online, there was, as I understand, a significant amount of testing. So someone who worked there, although as I understand it, most of those are now working on Watts Bar 2. So I don't know how many of those are walking around the street available.
Yeah, well, TVA is certainly, I think, the startup of Watts Bar 1, which had been shut down for, what, 25 years or something like that?
Well, of course, Browns Ferry 1 had been shut down for a long time.
That's what I meant to say.
And then they if I remember, it was 2005 through 2007, they refurbished, the plant, reconstituted all of the documentation, and did a large battery of testing to show that they could operate the plant. And of course, what especially helped them was the natural gas that everyone told me was going to be $2 per million BTU forever. Forever isn't as long as it used to be.
Well, it just amazes me, knowing what I know about gas and how quickly the supply-demand curve can change, why people would assume that it would stay at low prices for a long time if everyone started sucking on the same straw.
And, of course, folks always forget the things about exponential growth as well, how very quickly and how much you can use up in a single doubling time.
Absolutely. And we built in the U.S. an awful lot of natural gas-fired power plants because they were cheap and easy. And a lot of the companies that did that building, Dynergy, Enron, Duke Energy, El Paso, went through really tough economic times when the price of the gas skyrocketed. Their natural gas plants got down to the point where they're operating at an average capacity factor across the whole country is somewhere around 25% to 30%.
Yeah, natural gas, I still remember a seminar I went to back in the 90s where it was Hartford Steam and Boiler. Someone was giving a presentation and how easy they are to build, and you can, in fact, even the large ones, they were talking how GE had one of the big Russian cargo planes that you would just take out the shaft, put it on the big cargo plane, fly it out, it gets fixed, they fly it back in, and how much easier that was than other types of power plants. And then, of course, they said, well, the only thing that could stop us is if natural gas prices go up. And if I remember, there was chuckling in the audience because, of course, most of those guys there didn't think that natural gas prices would ever go up again, that they'd stay low forever. Just as even now, I read in the paper that hydraulic fracturing, the so-called fracking, and that's going to make natural gas stay low forever again.
Yeah. What people don't recognize is take a look at the drilling plans for the natural gas companies. I think Chevron has announced that they are going to stop drilling for natural gas in the U.S. because the prices are simply too low to support the investment necessary to do the fracking. Companies like Chesapeake Energy have significantly slowed their investment, which means that in a couple of years, the wealth of natural gas in the marketplace is going to change. Those companies aren't stupid. They're not going to invest a lot of money to keep producing gas at today's low prices because they're not making a whole lot of money at those prices.
Yeah, of course. And that's, of course, we've seen that in these business cycles before.
I mean, they're doing a bang-up job of trying to market natural gas and getting a lot of folks on their side. You know, the everybody who's anybody in Washington will readily acknowledge that natural gas is the cleanest fossil fuel. But, of course, I think the standards are pretty low.
Well, and, of course, natural gas is an easier sell because a lot of people use it in their homes. And so there's the illusion, familiarity giving you the illusion of knowledge that because everyone uses natural gas or everyone drives a car, that therefore gasoline and natural gas are very safe, and nuclear power, because it's used, you know, in some facility with guards and gates and with people who went to beach party schools like I did, you know, that therefore that's something very complicated and dangerous.
You went to a beach party school?
I went to UC Santa Barbara. The program does not exist anymore. Although, what's nice is my advisor is now the executive vice chancellor there. So there are actually a fair number of nuclear graduates that are out in the industry doing their thing. It's kind of a unique program. It was the university was out on a beach, but the the nuclear department, at least, most of the professors were MIT trained.
Yeah, see, I went to a boat school, so didn't spend much time on the beach.
I didn't have much time to spend on the beach between studies and creating troubles for the antis when I was in the student A&S chapter.
I'll bet that was fun. I think it, sometimes that the real challenge that we have is trying to get people who really care about the future to spend a little bit of time learning about the reality of what it takes to keep a society like ours running.
It is amazing how folks almost take so much for granted, and therefore they think it's somehow something that's really easy to do. An electrical grid is something really easy to build up. A supply chain is really easy to put together. Or unless it's something that has been portrayed as complicated, they'll assume that it's very easy.
Well, yeah, it is very easy. I mean, nuclear plants sort of operate themselves, and no, I'm just teasing. We do have a challenge. We need to be able to talk to the folks that study humanities, which is one of the things I try to do. I mean, I was a humanities major myself, and to me, one of the things that amazes me about nuclear is the poetry, the sheer magic of having so much energy come from such a small space and such a small amount of fuel and releasing so little to the environment.
That, in addition, it does not have the power temperature limits that fossil fuels, of course, you are limited also in how much power you can get out of them, and the fact that even, let's say, in pulverizing coal, you still have a finite surface area to interact with the air, whereas with uranium, the neutrons just fly right through until they find a nucleus to split.
Yeah, that is one of the biggest challenges. And when people think they understand combustion, but the challenge of mixing the fuel with oxygen is a big challenge in all combustion plants. I guess that's why gas is so much easier, because gas is already atomized and ready to mix with oxygen.
And also with the higher hydrogen ratio versus other hydrocarbons, it does burn. It has a higher energy per unit mass than the other fossil fuels as well.
Right, per unit mass. But yeah, per unit mass, it's also very expensive to move from place to place, which is one of the reasons why for many, many years, gas was considered to be a waste product that needed to be flared off.
Just as gasoline was originally a waste product because they wanted the kerosene to light lamps. Gasoline was the highly explosive, I still remember I should have saved it, but Scientific American every once in a while reprints their letters from the 1800s, and there was a letter to the editor that someone had written an article saying that, well, maybe we could use this gasoline and figure out a way to maybe explode it in small quantities and make it move something, and this person wrote in saying, oh, what a bunch of poppycock, you'll never figure out how to make a metal vessel able to withstand this tremendous explosive force of gasoline. And I was chuckling to myself, since we say the same things about like plutonium and some of the other products in nuclear fuel now, that they're somehow dangerous waste products.
Well, speaking of the dangers of gasoline and oil, I did want to mention that although the anniversary for Drake's first successful well is August 27th. On October 7th, we can celebrate the anniversary of the first oil well explosion and destruction, because Drake's well was ignited by gas and was destroyed. So on the 7th of October. So it didn't last for too long before he had to rebuild it.
What's interesting, though, about the history of these different fuel sources is when you look at it, when we first developed, for example, steam power, there were a lot of steamboats, for example, that exploded with tragic results, and coal mine explosions. Well, of course, we still have some coal mine explosions and fires today. But it is interesting that in the early parts of the use of nuclear reactors, especially with the the water-cooled reactors, for all of the talk about potential destruction, there really in the first 50 years hasn't been very much.
Well, part of that is that we understood pressure vessels already. The ASME codes were already very well developed, and I think that Admiral Rickover made a good choice in marrying up his brand-new, unproven heat source to a very well-proven heat engine. Do one thing at a time and do it and try to understand all of the challenges. And, the choice is pretty good, and it's lasted, even the next generation looks like it's going to be more light water reactors.
But even what's interesting is even outside of it, the Windscale fire, and even like people are talking now about the sodium reactor experiment, people are arguing over studies about long-term consequences, and of course we've talked about LNT and its misuse in many programs. But one thing that's almost missing from the discussion is neither Windscale nor sodium reactor accident. The sodium reactor experiment produced a big casualty accident the way that the first steamboats did, or the first uses of oil or natural gas did.
Yeah, but those people can make everybody afraid of, wow, we don't know what happened. We don't even really know how much got released. We can't know what the measured, because there were no measuring devices. Or I even hear the same thing about Three Mile Island, where there were measuring devices. There was some spotty coverage, but the way that they talk about it is if the plume was smart enough to narrow itself down and fit between the measuring devices and get directly to somebody, which is a bunch of poppycock.
We have smartphones and smart TVs, and I guess we have smart plumes, whenever I hear about these various these ones about, especially when they talk about, of course, about Milarems causing such havoc, I think of that line in the movie The Princess Bride when the guy says, "Oh no, he's only mostly dead."
It's inconceivable.
Yes. So it's but what's interesting is gasoline, and the combustion products of coal and oil are also carcinogenic as well. But I guess since people are familiar with them, they dismiss and it is a low risk, but people are more dismissive of a low risk when they are personally familiar with it versus something. I always wonder if reactors were in neighborhoods or something like that, if you'd had small reactors in neighborhoods, and people have been more familiar with them if there'd been not as much of a big secrecy issue with them early on, if people would think differently of nuclear power. There was,
I'm not sure if you can say just early on. I mean, one of the things we did to ourselves in the nuclear industry, although I'm not really part of the nuclear industry, I just watch it. One of the things the industry did to itself about hurting its public face is after the terrorist attacks of 2001, we closed down all of our visitor centers.
Well, and now I'm probably putting in a plug, but the Energy Encounter at St. Lucie is still open for business.
All right. But how close can you get to the actual reactor at that Energy Encounter?
Well, of course, it's in the training building, which is right next door to the plant. You can get a good view of the plant from the visitor center.
Yeah, I do think
that outside the visitor center, and there are other utilities that still have their visitor centers operating. So
I guess it's just the ones where the visitor center was inside the gate
that might be, because ours is outside the gate. So, there are still many visitor centers, and folks can go and learn all about goes on inside nuclear plants, and find that they're not as mysterious and scary. After all, people like me even can work in them.
I do believe that the more familiar people are, and particularly if anybody actually has the opportunity to go and operate a plant or visit a plant and look around really closely, and then go directly from that plant to a competitive plant, go to a large wind turbine farm, or go to a large solar collector area, or go to a coal plant, or even a gas plant, and make a comparison. Think about the difference in the quality of people, the quality of workmanship, the quality of everything, and the cleanliness of the facility. And you'll understand why some of us get so excited about this stuff.
Yeah, it's we certainly operate in a different atmosphere. I sometimes joke with folks that if oil, when it was discovered, if the government set up an oil regulatory commission, that I wonder if, when people said, oh, I'm going to go use gasoline in my car, and they'd be like, oh, no, we need a stack of paperwork first to show that this gasoline can be used in your car or something. It would be a lot different.
Well, I think, of course, I'm a cynic, and you know this, but we had a nuclear regulatory commission or an atomic energy commission established at a time when there was already a very prosperous energy industry. And who did we invite to be in charge of the atomic energy commission? For the majority, I think out of the first 10 commissioners, 7 of them came from the oil and gas industry. And the primary contractor at the Idaho National Laboratory, the premier reactor testing station, was Phillips Petroleum for the first 30 years.
And, of course, Rick overused the folks from the ones that had built fossil plants in developing the power plants for the submarines. Reinventing the wheel was not an option. I noticed when we're talking about the United Arab Emirates, they're setting up a separate nuclear company, ENEC, to manage their nuclear enterprise. We didn't have that option, of course, in developing the nuclear submarine. The conventional submarines were becoming obsolete rather quickly, and we needed the nuclear sub to be deployed.
Well, as you mentioned, I think the secrecy that was established by Rickover and his compatriots has hurt the industry, partly because some of the people that know the most about how nuclear plants can operate and how responsive fission can be have been told that they should never really talk about it, even if they don't expose any technical information. So that's what I try to do. I try to share at least the knowledge of what I did without really telling anybody how we did it.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, I know we've talked with him before, but, of course, Ted Rockwell, in his books, especially in his book on Rickover, The Rickover Effect, he gives some very good descriptions for the layman on the advantages of the nuclear reactors in submarines and how they use the feedback to kind of self help run the reactor.
Yeah, I used to tell people that one of the most boring jobs in the Navy is a submarine reactor operator, because he has very little to do, because the reactor basically takes care of itself in terms of keeping the heat production at the right level.
Yeah, there's a little bit more to do with the larger plants, because you have, with a larger system, they don't move as fast, and the momentum, and so the control systems are a little more in play, especially when you're maneuvering the units. They're not quite as complex to operate as folks might think.
Now, wait a minute. You said maneuvering the units. Does that mean that the reactors can actually do something besides operate as a bistable, where they're either on or off?
Oh, despite what I have gotten into that discussion many times, and sometimes I'll even hear people simply. I don't know if I've been called a liar, but people have questioned whether I really have been in a nuclear plant when I will tell them, for example, the Korean units, even Palo Verde, which was one of the more recently built units in the U.S., how they have reactor power cutback, how you know, even if you lose the turbine, you do not necessarily lose the reactor. So, the ability, of course, for load following the Kuiperk station in South Africa, because of the quality of their grid, that was one of the things that attracted them to the Framatome design, because it was they had more experience with the load following units, since the French use them a lot more for load following.
Yeah, I've been told many times that it's just impossible, and I say, obviously, you don't know what you're talking about.
And of course, the Columbia, actually the Columbia station, as far as plants that often do load following, the Columbia station in the Northwest, because of hydropower, they often have to do load following operations, and they're a boiling water reactor. So, turns out that they're pretty, I don't know if simple is the right word, but it is. Relatively easy to control these reactors and maneuver them as you need to.
It's interesting. I wrote a post on the Atomic Insights blog earlier this week in which I described nuclear energy as on-demand power. And I received, well, let's see, the total number of comments so far in that discussion is 55. And so many of them said, what are you talking about? How can you call it on-demand? And why don't you call biomass and geothermal on demand? And I tried to explain that, you know, biomass is not available all over. There's a lot of places that don't have biomass, and where you can't move biomass to places where nuclear reactors can operate and have operated. I mean, nuclear reactors have operated under the ice in the North Pole. They've operated on the landmass at Antarctica, under the ice in Greenland, all over the world's oceans.
And in outer space.
And in outer space, absolutely. So try using bio.
I was going to say, I was born during the time the Snap 10A was actually operating, so it has a special place for me that there were nuclear reactors that have operated in outer space.
Now, the U.S. has not operated too many reactors, but I know we have operated at least one. I don't remember what the number is. Do you?
Snap 10A was the reactor that was operated in by the United States. It was up in 65. I know it shut down in May 16th. It started up. It was latter half of April. It ran for about 3 weeks, and then it had a circuit problem, and the spring-driven control rods did what they were supposed to do, shut down the reactor, and it is still up there.
Okay. Now, and I know the Russians had a number of reactors, Topaz, I think is what they called them.
Yes, the Topaz, again, about 10 kilowatts. There have been talk of building larger reactors, but most of that has been experiments on the ground rather than actually putting anything into orbit. The United States has mostly used the what they call radioisotope thermoelectric generators, the RTGs. Mm-hmm. And actually, even besides those, even the ones that they say are solar powered, such as one of the more recent Mars Explorers, even though it was solar powered, but the electronics at night would freeze when the sun goes down, except there's a small piece of plutonium-238 in there. They keep the electronics in what's called a warm electronic box, WEB. And so even on the so-called all-solar rovers, there is usually a small little, if you will, radioisotope power source to keep the electronics at the right temperature.
Yeah, plutonium-238 is just a fascinating material. doesn't fission, but it sure gives off a lot of heat for an 87-year half-life, which means that after 10 years, the material is still giving off about 92 or 93% of its maximum amount of heat. Just a fascinating battery source. I mean, can you imagine running a laptop for 10 years and still having a power source that's producing 93% of what it was at the beginning?
And, of course, for a while they were using them in pacemakers. In fact, I have to quickly digress when they had to give my mom a pacemaker. She knew she'd heard me say once about those, and she actually asked if she could be fitted with a plutonium pacemaker, and they told her that those no longer are in use. So she was a little disappointed.
Yeah, I used to go up to the museum up in Baltimore, and they have an energy section up there, and I remember seeing a pacemaker battery, and it was smaller than the tip of my pinky, and that pacemaker battery could be installed into somebody's body and power a pacemaker designed for 15 to 20 years. You know why they were removed from service within the United States?
I had always heard it was that the lithium batteries were cheaper, but I would not be surprised if it was also just the regulatory headaches, because I know when I've gone to the NRC website, they even talk about, because I guess there's still some people with plutonium pacemakers, and they keep talking about, oh, make sure, when the person passes away that we get it back. So I would not be surprised if the medical industry also didn't just say, oh, this seems like a lot of bother when lithium batteries are pretty much just as good for most people.
Yeah, that pretty much is exactly what happened. Of course, the cost of the plutonium battery was driven a lot by all of the headaches and regulations and care and all that stuff, and trying to keep track of the people that had them just drove the regulators nuts. They couldn't figure out how to write regulations to get the bodies returned or get the pacemaker removed and in an autopsy, and so they just basically made it as hard as they could to force them out of the market. I'm pretty sure that you can still get a plutonium pacemaker in France and a few other countries. Positive about that. So, of course, I don't know what happens if you do get a plutonium pacemaker, if that makes you ineligible to travel to the United States for fear that you just might die while you're here.
Oh, well, sounds almost like the any fears about such small amounts of material sound like the, I think there was a Bloom County where Oliver Wendell Holmes builds a hydrogen bomb, and they ask him where he got the tritium, and he claims he scraped it off of 10,000 old watches.
Very patient man, I guess.
So, certainly there's been a lot of interesting things that have gone on with the nuclear technology, and it seems like things are coming back.
Well, I think that nuclear technology is the only place where the energy industry has the opportunity for something even roughly equivalent to Moore's Law. There is no such thing as Moore's Law of improvements when you're talking about collectors like wind or solar collectors. They just have to be way too large to be able to collect the amount of energy. But when you've got a fuel source that is 2 to 5 million times as concentrated as its competitors, you can have some amazing improvements in technology if we simply keep working at it and let each other innovate.
And certainly as they develop better materials, which can permit higher, the higher performance reactors, you'll certainly see a lot more improvements. There was an article I was reading that in the Idaho, I think it's the ATR Advanced Test Reactor, they are testing, when we hear about nanotechnology, there have been some nanotech alloy testing that has been going on there to see if some of that knowledge can be applied to reactor structural materials.
Now, help me understand, right now when we pull used fuel from the reactor. It's probably been in there for, what, about 6 years or so?
For a reactor that's a year and a half for each fuel cycle. They run three cycles, so about 4.5 years.
Okay, now what is it that causes that fuel to be no longer useful?
That's I want to say the one and the same. It's a simple thing. You have eaten up too much of your fissile material. As I'm sure you've talked about on other editions of the program, you do generate some plutonium in light water reactor fuel, and about, if I remember, 30 to 35% of the energy that comes out of a nuclear power plant is actually from plutonium. But even that amount, you do not make enough plutonium to make up for the uranium-235 that you are consuming. And so you basically start running out of material.
Well, the way we rotate the materials, you could keep fuel in there longer and try to burn it more by putting fresher fuel around it, but we don't. Is that because there's some sort of damage or some sort of limits on the maximum burn-up?
There are burn-up limits on the clad. In fact, the NRC, there's still some ongoing stuff with the NRC about how much burn-up can you have on clad, and not for regular operation, but for things like seismic loci. You know, you have an earthquake and the loss of coolant accident. Will your cladding hold up? These kind of things. Right now, it's around 65,000 megawatt days per metric ton, which is a lot of energy you can go on cladding. There had been talk of going up to 70,000 for light water reactor fuel. I have not had a chance to check how that's been going. I haven't heard of anybody putting in a license application, so my guess is that that's still something that's ongoing. There's groups like EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, that has a robust fuel program trying to develop those things.
Well, to put that in perspective, if you were able to burn up all of the heavy metal, you would be able to get somewhere close to 1 million megawatt days per ton. So we still got a long way of improvement to go from 65,000 to 1 million.
And that's where you're probably going to get into recycling, so that you can put the uranium to not only the fissile material, the remaining fissile material, but of course using your so-called fertile materials, whether it be thorium or uranium-238. And even actually, of course, other fertile materials you put in there, for example, plutonium-240 is also a fertile material.
Now, yes, you can do that with recycling, but if you were to try to improve the conversion from what it is in light water reactors today, which light water reactors actually waste a lot of neutrons. I mean, don't you guys put boron in your coolant?
That is true. We put boron in the coolant. The boiling water reactors don't use boron in the coolant, and they also have about the same burn-up limits on their clad.
The reason I asked that, I was reading today about some designs coming out of Japan. Now, they're not commercial yet, but they have done some squeezing out of the moderator to be able to produce a light water reactor where the conversion ratio approaches 1.0. And in some cases, at least in the simulations, the conversion ratio hits 1.0, which would mean that as you're consuming your fissile material, you're producing enough fissile material to make up for that loss. So the fuel could just keep going and going, like Energizer Bunny.
And, of course, that was one of the things talked about for the thorium core at shipping port, since that one actually did have slightly higher than 1 on the conversion ratio in a light water environment.
Yeah, the reason the shipping port core stopped operating was not because they ran out of fuel, but because it was being funded to keep the researchers around year after year. And eventually Congress said, well, when are you going to shut this thing down so that you can do the testing you want to do? Because otherwise we're going to keep paying these researchers for years and years, and they're sitting around waiting for the fuel to stop burning. And the fire was continuing to go.
Yep. And I've been to some conferences where they've talked about so-called 30-year cores, and even now some of the smaller reactor concepts are talking about you put something in and run the core for a long period of time. You don't have like an 18-month core that you'd have a 5-year, 10-year core. In fact, if I recall right, there's some mobile power plants that their cores run for a while.
Lifetime of the ship, by the way. But
yep.
to be fair, the ship reactors don't operate anywhere near the capacity factor that commercial plants do, because you don't need to operate a ship at 100% power, 8,000 hours a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we can make 30 years without anywhere near the kind of burn-up you would have to achieve to make 30 years in a large commercial reactor. With the small reactors, from what I can tell, the Toshiba 4S is designed to go for 30 years because it does have a breeding core. And I'm not sure. I think the Hyperion reactor is supposed to go about 8 to 10 years, and I think the B&W reactor is a more traditional light water reactor, but even that, the concept is for 5 years between refuelings.
Yeah, so there's certainly opportunities to stretch out the fuel savings and
of course there is a big problem that prevents that from happening, besides the licensing issues.
You're talking about for building these new reactors?
No, for stretching out the cores in existing reactors.
Oh, well, stretching out the cores in existing reactors.
Those designs of the Japanese I was talking about are designed to go into their existing light water reactors, particularly their boiling water reactors. But
let me ask, what is the enrichment they start off with?
I think it's like 5 or 6%.
Okay, because...
Like I said, they're getting 1.0 conversion ratio, so they can stretch the core a long time with that kind of conversion ratio. The challenge with getting that kind of improvement in nuclear fuels is the only people who can really push to get that kind of improvement are the people who sell fuels. What motivation would they have to improve the longevity of fuel bundles?
The only thing would be if you rejiggered the nuclear waste fund or something like that, where they would get incentives to do that, or of course if the price of uranium were high enough that the utilities would demand longer burning fuel.
Exactly. The only time that they would start producing longer burning fuel is if the customers demanded it, and in many cases the customers haven't really figured out that it's possible to go a lot longer.
Yeah, I know when I've talked to other utilities, I want to say in maybe the 80s, early 90s, there weren't that many utilities that were looking at their nuclear fuel costs, because they'd look at it compared to their fossil plants and go, oh my God, it's so cheap. Well, it's okay. We won't worry about what's in this fuel contract. Fuel contracts are looked at a lot more closely these days than they used to be. So I would not be surprised, especially if there continues to be a push from the utilities. Because there are public service commissions or public utility commissions. Since they get approved a fuel factor, but those commissions are starting to look again about, oh, well, how can you make it cheaper? How can you save the customers money? We may not give you the whole cost of fuel this time if we don't think you did enough to push your vendors.
Interesting. Well, Robert, it's been a wonderful time to discuss. I think we're reaching the one-hour time frame. So, you got any closing thoughts?
Well, just that certainly these are interesting times for nuclear energy all over the world, and I guess a great time to be a nuclear engineer.
It is a great time to be a nuclear engineer. My only real concern is that we don't encourage enough people to meet the demand that may cause us to have the only thing that's going to cause us to have a real shortage of nuclear talent here in the U.S. is if a lot of folks like you get lured away by folks from the UAE dangling large sums of money in front of you.
Well, of course, in my case, I have a family that I don't think they would. I'm not sure they would be amenable to that. And actually, okay. That's something we'll have to. Well, I mean, we have just like everyone else. You know, you have grandparents that are getting older, and so you know, something that just like all other families. So some folks are able to travel around, and some folks want to stay near a certain place, or some folks need to move to, let's say, be near a different school district. So I think if our industry is flexible and really opens up the initiatives, I think they'll be able to get all the different types of people they need, not just nuclear engineers, but all the skilled craft and all those other valuable personnel to build and run these plants.
Yeah, I actually hope that we don't have too many nuclear engineers, because if you have too many engineers, they'll want to start changing things. And one of the things we have to do is keep our designs pretty steady for a while and learn how to build them reasonably quickly.
That was the secret of the to the Koreans. They, I think I sent you a long time ago, there was a comparison slide between even Japan and Korea, and the Korean construction costs went down because they stuck to a single design and had a, I won't say a dedicated crew, but a cadre that was that had worked on most of the other units, so that they were able to get that learning curve going.
It's important. Well, Robert, take care of yourself. I was hoping you would say that there just wasn't enough money to lure you outside of the U.S., but you know, since you've already done your overseas time, but
well, of course, I'm sure my family's always willing to listen, but yes, for now we are here, and things are good.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Atomic Show. News is a little slow. It's the middle of August, but we put together a reasonably good conversation. If you have some spare time, a few nickels in your pocket, please go and visit tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com/pledge and make a donation to keep the servers operating, the bandwidth flowing, and all the infrastructure that enables free media to come to you unencumbered by commercial considerations. One more request. If you have some friends in the industry or some people that you know are interested in energy discussions, turn them on to the Atomic Show. Show them how to subscribe, and let's see if we can get the listenership of this show up just a little bit. Thank you very much. Bye now.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen. Learn. Evolve.